Hey Bill and Gutter, welcome to Black Hawk Tribal Edition. Murumu with you today here on the Yidinji Broadcast Service. And if you're listening to this show outside of the Yidinji Territory, then it's probably via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And we're broadcasting from the city of Gimoy in the tropics. And it's a beautiful time at the moment. There's a bit of rain about and a bit of sunshine, and it's a bit of a mix-up. It's good, and keeps you guessing. But joining me now is Ganyara of Yamamara. Good day. How you going?
Yeah, great. Thanks. Hey, another beautiful day in paradise. That's what you'll call it.
Yeah, it is. And look, there's been some interesting developments in recent times, and today we'll be talking about that. We're talking about compensation, restitution, and I guess those types of matters now. Recently, the King of the Netherlands, I think his name is William Alexander, travelled to Indonesia and to apologise for the colonial damage and injury that was caused there. And of course, there were many kingdoms prior to what people would call the Dutch Indies project and things like that, and they still exist today. However, a majority of people would identify as Indonesian, and it's caused a bit of a kerfuffle there, especially with the West Papua thing as well, and many others. So we're going to look at that today, Ganyara, and there's been recent court decisions I guess instructing the Holland, the Dutch, to provide compensation to victims of that. But first of all, let's listen to this short speech of His Royal Highness King William of the Netherlands.
In line with earlier statements by my government, I would like to express my and repeat regret and apologies for the excessive violence on the part of the Dutch in those years. And I do so in the full realization that the pain and sorrow of the families affected continue to be felt today.
Well, there you have it. Short and sweet, but at the end of the day, wrong was done. And how does one pay for that?
It's pretty difficult, isn't it, really? What they've done with that, they've actually put a price on a life. You know, 10,000 euro, roughly 17,000 Australian dollars. And there was one massacre, they reckon there was about 300, sorry. It didn't make sense to put a price on a life, you know, a dollar value. How much, 50 million quid, $50 million, and you have settled the price of massacring 3,000 people? That's not what the life of a person is worth, of a man or woman, sorry. But with this, it just raises some very interesting points. It was the king had to go there. Why didn't the head charang of, you know, the Dutch government go there?
Well, I think in the lead up to it, they would have prepared that. I think the Dutch foreign minister visited there in 2005 and gave his intentions about what was to come, and obviously they were laying that foundation. But maybe it needed the king of that particular era and now that capacity to actually make that apology.
Yeah, well, look, it was the Dutch East Indies project, all right. It sure was. But this was going on long before the war. It wasn't only the British that were colonial powers, the Spanish, the Portuguese, the Germans, the French, and the Dutch, as well as the British, are all going out conquering the world, or discovering the world, if you want to put it that way, which is the proper way that they said they discovered Australia. That means they were the first colonial power to move into here, and same over there.
Well, you know, the Dutch could probably lay claim to that as well, because they called it New Holland a long time ago, and they had their or nationals out here, Dirk Hartog and Van Diemen and all those ones. But you can tell they were moving around the place. And but it is interesting, you know, what it would have been difficult to, for for anyone to put a price on something. I mean, look, that's the nature of the world, the Bretton Woods, you know, institution of global markets and things like that. You just put a price on something and people might accept it.
Well, and that's what they really did. Now, they're saying, you know, they're going to pay reparations. You can't bring back a life. No amount of money can bring back a life. So, and then, curiously, they paid in you could say, in euro, which was converted to the local currency there in Indonesia. Now, what's the value of that? To get that local currency, you had to be an Indonesian. But it was the crimes were perpetrated before they were actually Indonesia. So this was happening to another group of people. And these were tribal people, you know, they had their own law there. They still do to this very day. So they had to give them money of the international world to the men and women of the tribal world. So they had to hold an Indonesian citizen, the Indonesian person, to take that money, had to have an account to put it into. So did they give the money to the right people? You know, which always raises the question, like I kept saying with anything done inside Australia. The Noongar lot, for example, is a good example. They give roughly $1 billion for the city of Perth, but they give it to Australians, black Australians. But do they give it to the Noongar people, per se, the Noongar tribe, or they give it to the Australian citizen? They had to give it to the Australian citizen.
And this is where that we've talked about it before. There's that lack of a legal mechanism to recognise not only the governments and of the tribes and whatnot, but also everything that comes along with that, the banking acts, the you know, the financial instruments. You know, Australia can't pay, or whoever it is, can't pay shells to a tribe because they struggle with that. They want to put a dollar on it because, you know, you can keep printing dollars and you can't just make up shells because there's, you know, you run out of shells in the ocean or whatever. But that's what we're looking at here, and I'm being a bit silly there, but in a nutshell, there is a clear inability for the UN to actually interact with the tribal world because it's two separate realms.
And that's acknowledged by the Uluru Statement from the Heart. The sovereignty of the tribes coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown. The UN Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People, Article 5, says you can go back and the Indigenous people can go back and rebuild all their stuff. If they want to, if they choose, they can take part in the life of the state. See, there's two entities there all the time. And even in Indonesia, you know, the before Indonesia lot, before the Indonesian government, per se what it is now, was something else. And, you know, in this case, like as in Australia, prior to everything, there was a colonial power there. Prior to them were the tribal people there. The colonials moved in, the Dutch colonials moved in, just do what they'd done in Australia, took land, massacred people to get them out the way, pushed them away to take the land and assets, and stripped the place of all its resources. Now, the massacres they're talking about took place after World War II, and that's not that long ago. 70, 80, 90 years ago. These powers were moving back. The Dutch wanted to get back after the war to take charge of what was there, which they thought was their resources. It really wasn't their resources. It was the resources of the tribes that were there. And however they governed themselves at that time is different to how the Dutch see that they governed the place.
And interestingly enough, the Yolno in what... the Dutch would call Northeast Arnhem Land, funnily enough. Arnhem is a place in Holland. We're actually trading with the Macassans from the Kingdom of Goa well before 1770. You know, those links continue today because I remember talking to people who actually went over there, you know, for the 500th anniversary of that kingdom. And so, like we're saying, those things still exist today. They're never going to die, but it needs men and women to keep that realm active and invigorated and keep it moving along. And just like King William is doing, right, from Holland, he's doing that And yes, there's a constitutional monarchy, probably. I'm not too familiar with the Dutch constitution. However, you know, when he's acting in his capacity as king, that personality is that capacity rather is different. There's two different forms of it. But anyway, I think it sort of sets an interesting precedent. But you know, you've seen the compensation awarded to the stolen generations in certain places inside the Australian realm, and some of it was like $7,000 or a little bit more. Some people didn't get it. I think the people in the Northern Territory are still waiting for theirs, for example. But once again, it's you know, what is the price really? €10,000 for the injury, that wouldn't even pay for the intergenerational trauma, for example, that experts talk about when it comes to trauma, and colonization came with trauma. You had the language beaten out of you, and all that kind of things that happened. People may have been arrested or shot and whatnot. So does $10,000 really cover it? And this is what we're saying now, is like, you know the value of things. And if you're thinking about compensation, you know, Article 28 of UNDRIP does say that. But you have also the ability, from your tribal point of view now, to create your government, to create your own wealth, to create your monetary system that through a treaty would interact with the rest of the world's banking institutions.
Absolutely. This is the hard part for the world to comprehend. Article 28 says, give back the land that you've taken from, all the resources, give it all back. Or give them something of equal stature, give them someone else's land of the same value, which they can't do, or pay them for the place. Now, what value, we'll go to Indonesia, we'll get away from Australia, we'll go to Indonesia. What is the value of those islands? You know, they're not getting any more islands, and the population is growing, so the land value is huge, really. They're covered in trees. You know, huge demand for rainforest timber.
Palm sugar.
All the whole lot there, like you said, the palm sugar, the mining, the whole lot, the fishing. All that resource belongs to the indigenous people, not Indonesia, not the Indonesian government, per se. They're just holding it in administration until these tribal people come back, which is why I question, why did the king, or why did the Dutch government, pay the Indonesian citizen money for what had happened? Why didn't it give it to the tribal people, the other lot that coexist with the sovereignty of the Indonesian government? Because they're all too busy. The reason they do it, they were all too busy being Indonesians. And it's a lack of education that causes that. The same lack of education that causes West Papua. Now, as brutal as it sounds, I have to support Indonesia for suppressing the Indonesian citizens that are rebelling in West Papua. Morally, it's wrong, but you have to support right with right. If it's right, if what Indonesia is doing is right, you've got to support them, even though morally it's wrong. It's the lack of education of those tribal people that don't understand what's going on. They think they're a different people to Indonesia. They are. They don't have the Asian look about them in Papua New Guinea. That's what I'm saying now. But they are holding the citizen of Indonesia. And Indonesia has every right to control its citizens and the holders of its citizens. This is the contract.
Yeah, well, that's right. And like you said, you know, there's been a lot of documented massacres there and things like that. And that's, you know, something that is really wrong. And that's where perhaps now the Dutch apologising for that, you'll probably in the future may see Indonesian president apologising for crimes against tribal people in that area described as West Papua or Irian Jaya. If those people identify correctly their capacity, and that's what we're encouraging the tribes of the world to do that, because as we're seeing now around the world, that state law or UN law those rights that come along with that, those benefits and things like that of participating in the state. In one foul swoop, we've seen restrictions applied worldwide, and now citizens inside those states. Some of them want to get out because they can see that the rights that they have been pegged back a few here and there, and you know, some say it's a police state in some parts of the world, and so there's those types of discussions, and that's what we're here to say. Look, have a look at this stuff, you know, and it's really important. We're not having a go at the West Papuan government. We can't do that. We can't have a go at any peoples on the planet. But all we're saying is perhaps this is why Indonesia is doing what it's doing, because they're applying the rule of law. And as you've said, Ganyara, that if they're holding that citizenship, then they're by consent, whether they agree or not agree. On paper, at least, they look Indonesian.
They look Indonesian, all right. And like you said, they're applying the rule of law to those in that the western part of that big island there called Papua New Guinea. They're applying the rule of law, but apply it fairly and evenly. Now, we'll go back to what happened with the money from the Netherlands. Apply the rule of law fairly and evenly. If you're going to claim that you can control the citizen in West Papua, then why are you giving money? Why are the Dutch giving money to the citizens of Indonesia over the other side where these massacres took place? They aren't applying the rule of law evenly. They're giving reparation money that belonged to a tribal member to an Indonesian citizen. That's wrong, technically. Mm. So they want to apply this rule of law evenly, across the board, right across the whole nation. So if you're going to have the authority to control your citizens in West Papua, control the citizens that should not be getting the money. The citizen of Indonesia should not be getting that money from the Dutch government. It was not perpetrated against, the crime weren't perpetrated against a citizen of Indonesia. They were perpetrated against the citizens or the members of possibly one of the tribal nations that were there. So you've got to do this fairly across the board, evenly.
And that's why we keep reminding people about the UNDRIP, the United Nations Declarations, rights of Indigenous peoples, and that to use that to further peddle your movement or your tribal expressions of sovereignty, because it's their document and you hold them to it, but you're using your piece of paper to do it, and that's the difference. You're listening to Black Law right across the Tribal Edition, right across the planet today, thanks to the Energy Broadcast Service. And if you're listening inside the Commonwealth of Australia or any other realm foreign to the Yidinji Territory, it's via the National Indigenous Radio Service. We'll be back. When a boy becomes a man, he must do the best he can to live his life and find his childhood dream. I've had, but the biggest break I've had was when I found that girl that thought of only me. Thank you for your smile and the love that's in your eyes. And thank you for the heart that's big and true. For the many things you are, my love, let me thank you for just being you. Let me thank you for just being you. Every man must make a few mistakes and put a few feet wrong. Sometimes I feel I want to say, forget it. But with my baby by my side, I can swallow foolish pride and stand upright to fight another day. Thank you for your smile and the love that's in your eyes.
thank you for a heart that's big and true. Thank you for the many things you are, my love. Let me thank you for just being. Great big world of woes and fears of dying. I wear a smile and not a frown, 'cause I know you'll be around to keep me full of happiness and love. Thank you for your smile. Thank you for a heart that's big and true. Thank you for the many things you are, my love. Let me thank you for just being you. Let me thank you for just being you. Let me thank for just being you. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the program. Ganyara and Murumu here with you today, and we're talking about the compensation and redress offered by the apology by the Dutch king, the king of the Netherlands, William Alexander, and also Article 28 of UNDRIP. Now, we've made this point many times, and we'll do it again today, Ganyara, that the Yidinji Nation has actually, in conversations with the administration of the Commonwealth of Australia, said that we are happy to forego Article 28, that Australia cannot afford to pay the Yidinji Nation what it truly owes the Yidinji Nation. It would bankrupt the Commonwealth of Australia, and it would also, if not bankrupt the Commonwealth of Australia, it would probably take away wealth from other tribal nations that may lay claim to the injury caused as well.
Well, I'll ask everyone out there, what is the value, the correct value, of the continent called Australia?
I'll tell you what, sorry to interrupt you, but I could not put a price on the heads on stakes on the Yidinji territory. I'm sorry, but it's really difficult for me to put a monetary value on it, or someone getting shot or injured, or, you know, when we talk with people that we know who have their families directly experiencing those things, it's not about the money. And it surely wouldn't, it would be an insult for me even to say, what do you think, should we go for $50,000 or $100,000, because it's not the point, right?
Absolutely, and that's why I just go back to this, what I said about what's the value of the whole continent. Can anyone, now this is only just the resource part, just the piece of land, let alone everything else that's happened, what is the value of a whole entire continent called Australia? Someone, work me out a figure. Give me a dollar value, in whatever dollar you want to call it, doesn't really matter, of a whole entire continent. The smallest continent in the world and the biggest island in the world, what's the value of that? Just the land value. Because if, you know, you go and buy a house in town, you go and pay $500,000 for a house, just one little house, you know, 300 or 400 square meters. Hang on. Let's extrapolate that over the whole continent. Is there physically enough money in the world just to buy Australia?
They'd have to keep printing more.
And that's what they've done in Zimbabwe. They sort of print this junk up, and that's all it is, just junk. It's currency. It's not money. The currency is just, I will give you this big note, this big pretty looking note which costs 3 cents, and that buys you off. Hang on, I'm not that cheap. And no tribal nation should be that cheap just to take a bit of pretty money or a pretty note off someone. Yeah. Let alone, like you said, the cost of the harm that was caused to the humans that were there. You know, the tribal citizens that were there. And it's still going on to this very day. Now, look, Australia did say, look, we're terribly sorry for taking your kids, which meant they did do some wrong. So there is a crime of genocide that has to be settled as well. How much money settles a crime of genocide? You know, it's an impossible figure to put on anything where harm was caused, mental harm was caused, physical harm was caused to anyone. So there is no dollar value for that. So you can't really set a dollar value.
Look, there was a court case, I can't remember where it was, but a woman fell upwards into stairs and laid claim to $1 million and was successful. Now, is that... I don't know the full details. You know, maybe she became a paraplegic, quadriplegic, I just don't know. But that there can shows you the abyss between... let's say a Western woman being injured and maybe some little tribal Jackie somewhere in the bush. You know what I'm saying? I just don't. This is the crazy part about that world of money.
It is. You know, she fell upstairs and got $1 million. What about Dumuji that fell over a step on Palm Island? Now, what happened to the value there? You know, she gets $1 million for staying alive and falling up a step, but he was alleged to have fell over. You know, I don't know whether it was on the end of a boot or not, but he was allegedly to have fell over and died. What was the value there? See, there is no fairness, no equity in this world of money. Now, that bloke is still going at large, the perpetrator. He's still out there and out and about. He, sadly, Dumuji's gone. So you see, this idea of money can fix things up, it can't. Money can never fix things up. So don't look at the world of money. It's wrong. That's why we have to say to the world, you cannot, and we've said this to a number of senators, you cannot afford to pay us here, let alone the rest of Australia. And they agree. They said they can't. Unless they're going to print money, which makes it worthless, or print currency, it's worthless. So what's the good of having that?
Yeah, it's about right and wrong. It's not the price is right. It's never about the price is right. And when we talk about these things, we're very, very careful because we don't... there are people obviously inside of Australia operating, and yeah, fair enough, that's good. Use it to your advantage, but if you can, build this other world. You know, that the reality is 99.9% of the planet is operating in the world of the UN laws and things like that. And however, it's your system. You own it. This is the difference. When you step back into your world, your tribal society, you actually own that world of commerce and things, but don't touch it. That's somebody else's stuff. It's made for someone else. All you do is to say, okay, in exchange for this, I want this. I want your money. I can make money just like you. I can do these things. And I think... You know, that's a very, very layman's term summary of it. But before you get to that point, there's some basic steps that we've talked about also on this program that you need to do.
You're right. And that's why, with this stuff going on in Indonesia at present, as we were talking about West Papua, they're trying to break away from Indonesia. They're trying to form another UN member state away from Indonesia, and that's wrong. Indonesia was granted this territory to oversee by the UN itself. You can say all the UN member states agreed, and this is how they done. They just got a map out and just drew lines with a pencil around the globe. Australia, you control this part. Papua New Guinea, you're over here. Indonesia, you're there. India, you're over there. So they just drew a line. So don't try and break away from and create another new state. Just use UNDRIP. We choose at Article 5, 3, 4 and 5, we choose to look after ourselves, we choose to self-govern, and we choose to revitalise all our institutions, while we still retain the right, if we so choose, to take part in the life of Indonesia. So if those tribal people in the western end of that big island up there, that you want to just call New Guinea, those people on there can choose to go back under Article 3, 4 and 5 of UNDRIP and tell Indonesia, look, we don't want to break up Indonesia. We want to leave it where it is. But we're going back under these articles to do our thing. And Indonesia, being a member state of the UN, should, and it must, comply with what it agreed to. It can't stop these people doing that as long as they're not trying to harm Indonesia itself or trying to break it up.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, the thing is, they can go down that track. But you know, it's coming at a cost. Let's say, the way that it's being done currently. You know, East Timor did that, yes, and some other countries around the world have done that. But I thought, what we talk about here is what is the most peaceful way to do it with low impact on lives and things like that and suffering, and that's what the Udinji Way is all about. And so we're not. All I'm saying is that you know the tribes over there. We hope that and some of the tribal people live on the Udinji territory. You know, have a think about that. One of those things is that people are contacting the Udinji Nation from around the world and looking at how we're doing it. And you know, it's every day we do it. It's not just a part time thing. Literally, it's rebuilding a copy of your tribal society, but on paper. And this is what it's all about. It's creating your laws on paper and agreeing to create those laws on paper. And that's what the rest of the world can see, and that's what they love. They love that paper. So, you know, you build that world and they will come.
And that's what they don't have in West Papua at present. They do have tribal laws there, which they applied, you know, just under the radar, so to speak, just locally. But if they rebuilt their governments and put them on paper and said to Indonesia, look, we want you to go out and do our international work. We want you to represent us internationally. When you go to America, when the Americans are annoying us here on our little island, we want you to go over there and tell them to steady up or to whatever your case may be. So you're going to appoint Indonesia as the representative body internationally, not governing your little area, not governing your territory, but to do your international bidding. And equally, when the Dutch king come out, they should not be giving that money to the Indonesian citizens because they have no right to it. It was never perpetrated against an Indonesian citizen. It was perpetrated against one of the tribal members. So let's get this right. And Indonesia should be saying, yep, that, you're dead right with that. But they can only operate, Indonesia can only operate in the international world, the money of the UN. Whatever the currency is that they've agreed upon internationally is what it is. But tribally, it's not. Different worlds altogether. So we've got to understand this. So if we're going to apply the same rule across the board, it's got to be equal. So don't give the money to the Indonesians, give it to the tribal people. And over there in West Papua, the Indonesian citizens must toe the line, obey the law, but you have a right. You have a right under your tribal stuff to go back and rebuild all your stuff. So you can always say to Indonesia, look, we don't choose to take part in the life of the state today. We may in the future if you're going to be doing our bidding properly. So look, no modern government around the world I can see has consent from any of the tribal people yet to be present upon the territories of those indigenous nations. This is so important to understand. The UN, just because they said we're here, does not give them consent to be there. You know, Australia is a good example of it. Australia was one of the founding members of the UN. And they said, yeah, we'll govern this big territory called Australia and its islands. But does it have consent from any of the tribes? And even in the words of the Australian ministers, our MPs and prime ministers, they're saying, well, we don't have consent to be here yet. We're settled without treaty and consent. So they know that. But where are the tribes? The tribes are too busy being Australian, operating in Australian dollars. And they have to at this stage to feed the family, to keep life going. But you should be rebuilding all your stuff behind the scenes, getting it up to a stage where it can be seen by Australia. And this brings us to another interesting case recently down in New Zealand, where with this lockdown going on and all this sort of jazz.
Well, we might go to a break first, and then we'll come back and talk about it, because it's a very interesting subject on... you're listening to Black Law Tribal Edition right across the planet today. Moirimu and Ginyara with you. We'll be back after the break.
He said to me, hey little black girl, won't you come away with me? Little
Welcome back to the program. Now, Ganyara, the we just mentioned before the break there that we'll go over to New Zealand now. And because of the coronavirus restrictions that have been in place in New Zealand, one of the citizens decided to take it to the High Court, and their attempts to, I guess, revoke those restrictions or to have them suspended for some period of time failed. And this was a really telling case because at the end of the day, the state is the boss. And when it comes to, let's say, interests of the nation, martial law can be used, other laws can be introduced, and temporarily or for an extended period of time to ensure that the nation is being taken care of. And this High Court case was very interesting.
And it can only apply to its citizens or citizens of another UN member state to which New Zealand has a treaty with. It doesn't apply to those, to the Tangata Whenua, the original tribal people underneath. It can't apply to them because they are in this sovereignty that coexists with the sovereignty of New Zealand. Mm. This is the important part. Now, you've got to look at it. You got to look at New Zealand or any UN member state. You've got to look at it like a company. There's the boss of the company. There are those underneath the boss who, you could call them foremen or whatever, that hand out, you know, the directions. And then there's the workers. And the citizens are always the workers. The workers always must do as they're told. The boss of the company sets a direction. So, and the workers must obey. So what they've done there is said, look, we've got to look after the citizen. It's our obligation under the reciprocal arrangement of citizenship that New Zealand must protect its citizens, its workers. So they locked the place up. They said, everyone stay home, don't go out, don't do this, you can't do that. And the citizens were getting a bit jacked, but some of them were getting a bit, well, I'm had enough of this, I want to get out and go and do my stuff. But it's the citizen that is controlled by the agreement of citizenship, which is the reason why that one had to fail. The boss of the company, Jacinda Ardern, she's the boss. She said, we'll do this. And all the employees of the company must do as they're told. And this is what was going on. It had no choice but to fail, was to try and challenge it, something that the boss had said was set to fail right from the very start. You can protest or you can write her a letter and say, look, I don't believe this is right. And if she gets enough pressure applied to her through the citizens, she might change her tune. You know, so, okay, if 90% said we don't want the lockdown, she would have to comply with that. You know, basically, okay, let's change it around to suit the nation.
Even if that did happen, she still has the executive power to steamroll that and make it. So if the case is there that flu or whatever it is is actually going to go and infect a majority of the population and cause the state to come under huge amounts of stress on the public health system, immigration and border patrol, all that kind of stuff, right? So the point here is, tell us sort of in a nutshell what happened in that court case, why did it come about, I did sort of give the result of it, but why would someone do that?
People have lost a lot of money out of this. They really have. They can't go to work. You're told, stop your business right now today. You can't go and run a business. Or you can't go to the fish and chip shop. You can't go and sit down to a restaurant. You can't. You can't go out. You can't go to the park. Can't go to the beach because you might transmit the virus. So some people think that they have freedoms. You only have rights. Rights that the state will grant you. You don't have freedoms. This is a very important thing to remember. There's no freedom inside. When you go to work, when you go and work for Coles, for example, or you go and work for Toyota Company or Ford, when you walk in their door in the morning to start work, you are to do as you're told by the company. The company will say, look, John, you're going to make wheels today, but you don't feel like making wheels. You know, you feel like you want to make windscreens. Well, the company is going to be completely lost, for example. They're going to have all these windscreens and no wheels. How do you make a car with all windscreen and no wheels? They have a set role for everyone to do. So the same here. You've got to look at it just like that. The citizen has to do as he's told. just like the worker has to do as he's told and go and make wheels today.
If you don't like it, go to another company, right?
Precisely. You can leave. You can go back to your company. You can go and set your own company up, which is what UNDRIP's all about. Go and rebuild your stuff. So Jacinta had every right. The New Zealand government had every right to shut everyone up, shut its citizens. And if you're holding a citizen, you must do as the boss says. So they got jack of this. They were, we've had enough. This has cost us dearly. We'll challenge it. This lock-up, you're not going to lock me up anymore type stuff. And eventually had to get to the court where the court said the citizen must do as they're told.
Yeah, I think people are a bit concerned with the business side of things and the fines and the amount of the monetary value fixed to those fines. But it's just another simple demonstration of, look, when it's tight, the screws will be tightened. And if there's fear around the place, then don't expect freedoms. It's going to get tight, and the state chooses to do that. Now, this is a very important message, because like I said, we just had a few more inquiries about people wanting to become citizens. We will not be accepting any citizens while this period is on. We'll accept applications and submissions, rather. But in terms of transfers and all that kind of stuff, we've had quite a number of requests now, because I think people can see the writing on the wall. But once again, the Unity Nation has its laws to uphold and the safety and security of its persons and dominion and all these things.
Well, let's have a look at a bit of a hypothetical. Hypothetically, all the Indigenous tribes come back and form their governments across Australia. They all come back. So you've got 3% of the population of Australia said, okay, look, have a nice day, Australia. We're going back to our world. That still leaves 97% Australians. So these people went back and rebuilt all their governments. But they're not part of a Commonwealth of Australia. They're separate to the Constitution of Australia. So now you've got 97% of these people, of human mass on the continent, now as Australians, who have no consent to be here. Can they exceed their constitution and harm the citizens of the Indigenous nations now? You see what I mean? They have no right to go out and take any of the resources, do any harm, cut any trees down, destroy anything that belongs to these tribal nations. This 3% now have the law, they own the place. So Australia must make its citizens compliant to cause no harm to the owners of the place. So they got to tighten the screws right down on them. This is hypothetically. If this was to be the situation, the tribes come back, rebuild themselves all over the place, Australia must pull all its citizens into line and tell them, don't you dare harm anyone that's not part of our world. You can't touch us. As the judge said here, if you're not part of our world, you're free to go at large. So for anyone to go outside and harm those tribal people would be committing genocide or crimes against humanity, war crimes, for example. They have no right to go and touch them people, that 3%, that are not Australian. So how would Australia control its citizens? By martial law. It's the only way is to, like you said, tighten the screws, is to contain them somewhere so they don't exceed the value of the Constitution, they don't exceed the authority the Constitution vests in Australia. Otherwise, they'll destroy the Australian Constitution. It's not worth a cracker if you exceed what it says. So they've got to. That Australia has to control its citizens. There's no other option to it. So you see what I'm saying there? This is a hypothetical. It may never happen, but it may also happen.
Yes. Well, there you have it. I guess we've covered a bit of ground here today on Black Law Tribal Edition. Look, I hope you enjoyed today's program. It would be interesting to see what conversations are being had now in relation to this Dutch apology and compensation measures that are being, whether the UK will actually follow suit here. And, we'd welcome Charles and Camilla back any day, or Elizabeth and Alexandra Mary to the Yidinji Territory. They're most welcome to come here and talk to the Tribal Society. And let's see what happens. But anyway, Gai Barakalanyunda, may God's peace be upon you. through his only begotten son, Yeshua HaMashiach, who's coming back soon, by the way. And we'll talk to you soon. I'll catch you next week, Ganyara.
Thanks, Garu.
Hey, Garu.
Why you wanna do that?